Michaels.
Aqua International Partners and Senior Advisor, TPG Capital.
Thank you. Well, the last session I thought was hugely thought-provoking. I never imagined I was doing so badly, making all those left turns. There is a very funny biography of J. Edgar Hoover entitled No Left Turns. He apparently was hit sitting in the back right rear once doing a left turn. He then moved to the left rear and instructed the FBI when he and Clyde Tolson made their investigations of FBI offices never to do any left turns again. Who knew he was so green before his time? Well, the essence of Clinton Global Initiative is commitments. Commitments and progress on commitments. And I have the pleasure to announce some now and to invite the people responsible to join me on the stage. And the first people I'd like to invite up are Tatiana Van Leer, who is Executive Director of the Association of Charity Lotteries in Europe, one of the major philanthropic supporters, I must say, for environment generally and for World Wildlife Fund in particular, something close to my heart, and Warner Phillips, founder of Lemnis Lighting, who seems to have had several people planted in the various conversations here because I've heard the name at least five times today. Would you both please join me on the platform here? Welcome. I'm going to get a picture in a minute. And let me read what, in fact, they are committing to do. Hold on a sec. In an effort to address climate change by improving energy efficiency, which we've just been discussing, the Dutch National Postcard Lottery, along with its partners, is committing to distribute Ferox LED lamps to 2.5 million households throughout the Netherlands. These LED lamps use only 10% of the electricity currently utilized by incandescent lamps. Unlike conventional light sources, they do not depend on toxic mercury and can last for up to 30 years, longer than many of us. The current model of these lamps will be introduced in January 2009. An additional 500,000 WWF supporters will also receive information on the LED lamps. The Dutch National Postcode will also furnish the home and office of President Clinton with the Ferox 3 lamps. This is a commitment of some $44 million over 1 year. That's not to the president's house. This is a terrific achievement. We've just been hearing about lighting and lamps, and it's my pleasure to present you in a commitment. You got it already. Oh, so you do. Okay, I'm told we're supposed to be sure to get a good photograph this year. Pay more attention to it than last year.
Thank you.
Next, I would invite Claudio Osario, Chief Executive Officer of Innovida Holdings, to join me up here.
Innovida,
is that how I say it?
Yes.
Innovida is committing to build 1,000 self-sustainable energy-saving homes in India. Each home will have solar panels that will generate enough electrical energy to run the entire house without connection to a power grid. It will also have an internal water treatment system that will collect rainwater and recycle it into drinking water. The homes will also be constructed with Innovida panels that are non-flammable, waterproof, and strong enough to withstand catastrophic earthquakes and other natural disasters. Over the span of 1 to 2 years, this commitment will help provide shelter for 8,000 people. This is a $20 million commitment over 1 to 2 years on some matters that are hugely important to much of the world, but particularly to India, where I have been very active in drip irrigation business. Congratulations. I now invite to the stage Dr. Ivan Azurda, Bravo, Executive Director of the Fundación Solar.
I'm here.
Okay, congratulations.
Thank you. Sneaked up on me.
The Fundación Solar, along with its partners, is committing to combine new modern technologies with the existing knowledge of indigenous Mayan communities to develop small-scale businesses that value environment and cultural values and can also adapt to risks caused by global warming. It will help create a minimum of 120 grassroots businesses in agroforestry, tourism, and handicrafts, providing at least 1,000 jobs and raise awareness at the community level. Over the course of 3 years, it will have a positive impact on 8,400 poor people, of which 5,100 are children. This is a commitment in Guatemala of over $1.5 million over 3 years. Congratulations.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Bless you. Let's take your picture.
Thank you very much. Muchas gracias.
Gracias.
Excuse me.
Okay. We're now going to recognize a progress report. Christiane Eibsinger, Deputy Executive Director, E-Plus Company. Would you please join me on the stage? With more than 25 years of experience in the design and implementation of public-private partnerships, Christiane Eibsinger is the Deputy Executive Director and has been with E-Plus Company since its inception. She's responsible for investor relations and strategic planning and fundraising. She's also played an integral role in the design and implementation of the United Nations Foundation REED, that's Rural Energy Enterprise Development Programs, UNEP program. Has more than 10 years before that with the Port Authority of New York City and New Jersey, which would prepare you for a lot of hard work, concentrating on the development of public-private partnerships. Congratulations.
Thank you, and Bill actually gave me my commitment last year, so it's great to be back to report on progress. E&Co is a 15-year-old U.S. nonprofit organization that invests capital in services in clean energy enterprises in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Last year, we announced our commitment to build on the experience we had in investing in more than 180 energy businesses that were serving 4 million people with clean energy and at that point offsetting 3 million tons of carbon. We committed to put in place the partnerships and funding to invest $190 million of services and capital in local energy businesses, bringing clean modern energy to an additional 17 million people and offsetting an additional 15 million tons of carbon. We committed to implement an innovative financing program to monetize the carbon offsets generated by our investee companies, sharing the carbon revenues with our entrepreneurs. And we committed to change business as usual with respect to energy, environment, and development by tapping into the potential of local energy entrepreneurs. Since I stood here with Bill a year ago, I am very proud to say that E&Co has invested $24 million in 50 new energy enterprises in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Enterprises that allow local men and women entrepreneurs to manufacture and sell fuel-efficient cook stoves, reducing indoor air pollution from cooking with firewood and charcoal, to deliver water using locally made windmills, to turn agriculture waste into energy, and to build small-scale hydroelectric projects in Guatemala and Honduras, where more than 70% of the electricity is diesel-based. Today, each of these enterprises is producing financial, social, and environmental, or triple bottom line, returns to IANCO, its funders, and our stakeholders. How did we get here? Over the last year, we put a number of significant stakes in the ground that are necessary for our growth and success. We completed a private offering memorandum for qualified investors, for IANCO People and Planet notes, and are now gaining momentum in placing these notes with institutions like Prudential Social Investment Fund. In July, we entered into an agreement with Goldman Sachs, a very innovative agreement where Goldman Sachs will buy all of the carbon offsets generated by IANCO investee companies. In partnership with Accenture, we're going to be looking at the operating model that underlies IANCO to ensure that it has the rigor and the flexibility to do what needs to be done in 25 developing country markets. And working very closely with Weil, Gotshal & Manges, an internationally recognized law firm, we're engaged in looking at financing agreements with OPIC and the Development Finance Institution of a number of European countries, France, Sweden, Norway, and the United Kingdom. And we've closed both grants and loan funds from the Citigroup and Deutsche Bank Foundations, as well as from the Wolfensohn and Halloran Grant Foundations. It's not been a bad year. But we're not there yet. I welcome the opportunity to talk with you to figure out how we could work together in partnership to support IANCO in our work to deal with local energy entrepreneurs so that they can provide the goods and services that are necessary to fuel economic development, alleviate poverty, and reduce our climate stress. Thank you very much.
One of the great benefits of Clinton Global Initiative is to put people together with resources, with people who have ideas and programs. I'm struck by, and was in the last conversation, how so many good things have happened first in the private sector and then were brought in a public-private partnership to get government support. One of the most interesting to me is the LEEDS program, which came out of the architectural community. And without a LEED certification, I understand you can't really get a mortgage in California now to build any kind of significant office building, not because regulations or law require it, but simply the ethos has caught on in the building community and among tenants and everybody else. These are marvelous commitments. We are very pleased to recognize all of them, and I would encourage you one last time to applaud those who have made them and also Christine for the progress report on the one that she made last year. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the stage our moderator, Andrew Winston.
Great. Thank you, everyone. That was wonderful. We got some great questions, and what we're going to do is a lot of them are sort of in a similar theme, so we're just going to sort of combine a bunch and all sort of comment on one general idea. There were a lot of questions around how do you incent this? How do you get organizations and consumers and everybody to seek out energy efficiency? So different ideas. Do we need tax incentives? What role does the federal government play? You know, mandatory standards on, you know, air conditioning, on other equipment. The idea of the U.S. Green Building Council and to some standard like that, the LEED certification, can you do that in other venues? So I'm going to ask everyone to sort of comment on the general idea of incenting and sort of take a crack at it from their point of view. So.
There are several things I would highlight, but the one I'm going to focus on, given our time constraints, really picks up from this notion of how much consumers are going to play a role in energy demand going forward. And you mentioned earlier about the very high discount rates of consumers. The reality is that in the developed world, consumer end uses are actually more energy demand now than the industrial uses. And so incenting the consumer is actually very important. And we find that there are reasons that consumers are not at all rational in the choices that they make, even with very high oil prices, even with very high coal prices. So although we are a place that has a lot of respect and appetite for market mechanisms, probably in the area of electric appliances and machinery, the strongest case can be made for direct intervention in the form of standards. And the reason for that is that there is actually a small handful of OEMs, of original equipment manufacturers, that make most of this electrical appliances and machinery. So they have the capital, they have a value chain that is able to make these changes through quickly, and once you get the right products onto the shelves, consumers will make at least best decisions than if they are given that low efficiency argument. So what we have found is that the impact of pretty strict standards that are in place today, say in Europe or Japan, on electric appliances and machinery is tantamount to 16 quad BTU, which is, put it this way, it's the equivalent of 610 power plants that would not have to be built. That's how big this opportunity is. So that would be the one case for an intervention around standards for appliances and equipment.
So just market prices alone, you think, can't get us as far as we need to go?
Well, I'm skeptical because we've had over the past 2 years, really a doubling of oil prices. Most people don't realize we've had an even higher increase in coal prices over the last while. And while we have begun to see behavioral change in the form of, say, in transportation, lower vehicle miles traveled, and otherwise, we are not getting the elasticities to these extraordinary price increases that we would want to get. And as we look at consumer behavior, a lot of the work that behavioral economists have done to understand why consumers make the choices they make, it's hard to believe that given how small energy is as a percentage of the entire value add in any purchase decision, that price alone will be enough to get us there.
Well, Jane Jacobs, the urban theorist, pointed out that humans have evolved two syndromes of survival, she called them, which are the guardian and commerce. And I think it's really interesting. I think Bill's remark that the LEED program came out of the designers, you know, as one of the founding firms for the LEED program. The fact is that commerce is the engine of change. And the regulators seem to chase commerce in the form of creating standards if they find that the commerce is producing things that aren't in society's benefit and so on and so forth. But I find this aspect of commerce leading really quite interesting. And one of my roles now is not just as an architect, but I'm a venture capitalist with Vantage Point Venture Partners. And we're looking at all these new technologies that will be coming out to take on these issues. We're looking at them from the commercial perspective almost irregardless of the regulatory environment because they're the right thing to do, and we see that the economics are going to be powerful. We then work back upstream to see what the regulators would find themselves doing at that point in time. But really the commerce is going to be driving a lot of this. So the questions that we got had a lot to do with leadership. Who's going to lead this? And I think we're going to see that commerce is the engine of change.
Great. Thanks, Bill. And I think that leads us to one of the great examples lately that I find fascinating is Walmart setting its own standards on toys and how much lead you can find in toys. And those standards are, I think, 85% more strict than the federal government. So, you know, I talk to companies and say, well, who's compliant? Who are you complying with? What does compliance mean anymore if you can't get on the shelf without hitting certain standards? So maybe from Walmart's perspective, you could talk about both that pressure on suppliers and how you communicate with consumers and incent their changes. There was a question about, you know, how do you communicate in stores since people say they're not seeing that much in Walmart stores talking about this?
Well, certainly within the supply chain, actually it was 2 years ago we made a commitment at the Clinton Global Initiative to work with our manufacturers to reduce packaging by 5%. We're doing those things throughout our entire supply chain. But certainly the consumer opportunity is large too. This year we made a goal internally to start working with our suppliers to reduce the energy use of television sets. So the numbers we hear about is about roughly $5 billion of energy every year are used in the United States just to power TVs. And so we set a goal by 2010 to work with our suppliers to reduce the energy use of television sets by 30%, along with the energy-intensive products by 25% that we also sell and only sell Energy Star air conditioners. So certainly there's a role we can play within the supply chain. But certainly I think the efforts that we put forth this last year, that really our marketing team led at Walmart in working with our supplier base to, I think, make a really impactful statement when it came to Earth Month, as we called it, in April. I think it's just an opportunity for us to do more messaging, but also, too, for those of you who work with us, we are incredibly cheap. We are very thrifty, and we cannot drive up the cost of our products because of marketing. So it is it's a balance. It is how can we message better than we are today, let the consumer know what is available, work with the supply chain, but certainly keep costs low because that is our mission to save people money.
Great. Thank you. Katie, what about the incentives from the state and federal level?
Yeah, I mean, let me agree with Bill in terms of the role of commerce. But I do think that the price points are essential, that commerce steps up and puts this on the agenda for those board meetings when all of a sudden energy or utility costs are up there with health care costs and labor costs and other things that the board has to pay attention to. When that goes away and price points fall through the floor, these issues are of interest to the guy on the line maybe, but they don't make it up to the decision makers often. I do think that regulation can help or hurt. We do have some regulations that hurt because, for example, accounting regulations. So for buildings and how you account for capital plant and equipment, when there is a wall between how you're allowed to keep the books for capital investments and a wall that separates out the operations and maintenance books, that upfront capital cost is tough to justify when you can't look at, but wait a minute, my operational costs are much reduced. So I do think that smart regulation is a part of the equation. Again, if I had to pick one most important of all, it is that conventional energy prices stick and stay at prices that make people pay attention.
Great. I think, you ready? Great. We're going to bring up Deputy Chair PJ Simmons to talk about the themes that you guys collected in your discussions.
Well, as always, this was like drinking from a fire hose. Extraordinary amount of great ideas, but so these are just a few highlights. First, in the realm of successful examples, many people mentioned California and its appliance standards and how it's managed to flatten out per capita energy use over the last 25 years despite a lot of growth. Procter & Gamble was mentioned by a couple of people for cutting waste in some of its products, including diapers, and creating recyclable diapers in response to consumer demands. Many people recommended looking to other countries. There's a mayor's boot camp in China that is promoting energy efficiency in various cities. In France, there's a bike sharing program that makes it easier for people to bike and also makes it fashionable and cool. And the UK, a block-by-block approach to educating about energy efficiency. And someone mentioned a solar pool cover that saved them $15,000 over 8 years and only cost $300. In terms of what it would take, many people mentioned the importance of a coherent, holistic approach nationally and national energy efficiency strategy. Education of consumers on energy-saving actions came up repeatedly, but this idea of giving feedback instantly through smart meters, like we see with the Prius dashboard and so forth, also raised several times. Raising standards for consumer goods, tax incentives to support behavioral changes, and government coordinating procurement efforts to further energy reductions, like mandating the implementation of LED lights in its green vehicle fleets. Excuse me. In terms of what it would take, some additional recommendations, government-sponsored green skills training and job programs, low or no interest loans for energy efficiency investments, given some of the upfront costs, educating small and medium-sized businesses on these opportunities, recognizing that a lot of small and medium businesses need the toolkits and ideas to get going on these areas, legislation and incentives to support green building, and business leaders acting as advocates for mandatory CO2 reductions. And finally, just a few gems. One person mentioned attaching a cultural stigma to inefficiency and waste. Another said that every home should have a smart metering system, creating centers of excellence in universities to provide data to the public and policymakers, creating a clean energy core modeled after the Conservation Corps, an XPRIZE for creating a smart energy grid, and forcing drivers of SUVs to pay insurance for small car drivers. Thank you. Back to the panel.
One of the topics that I think is interesting is the small and medium-sized business point that was raised. Does anybody want to comment on, everything we've been talking about has been pretty big scale, what this means for the half or plus of the economy, and especially in the developing world that is at the smaller level? Do you have a thought?
In some ways, you would argue that the smaller businesses have the most to gain because they tend to be closest to the margin, a lot of these. The reality is whether we have the technology that is worth their while to get knowledgeable about and invest in and otherwise, given all their priorities. But if we come back to where the biggest opportunities are, which is in buildings, and whether this is residential or commercial, depending on what part of the world you're talking about, it would seem that every business has some level of opportunity within the buildings that they have. So I think we come back to the things that are not really that sexy but extremely important, which are lighting, heating and insulation, heating, cooling, and insulation. And that's a message that carries equally whether you're a small scale or a large scale.
I think that, looking at it through designer's lenses, design is the first signal of human intention. And a regulation is really a signal of design failure because regulators having to step in because something is untoward is a signal that the design is imperfect. And I think what's exciting to me is not just the fact that we can mine our existing systems for their inefficiency, which I think is obviously a critical issue in what we're here to talk about, primarily, but also the idea of leaping outside of the system to develop whole new strategies that change the game. And I know there would be a clean transportation panel, but when you look at what they're looking at in Israel right now with Shai Agassi's Better Place program, they're looking at creating an electric car system that has power points at all the parking spaces, all connected with an intelligent communications grid and so on and so forth. And it's requiring the government to do things with tax incentives. It's requiring Renault-Nissan to develop electric cars in a hurry. It's developing urbanistic decisions about where these parking spaces will be and how personal mobility will be deployed and so on and so forth. And it all came out of a single question that was asked of Shai, which was how to make the world a better place. And his decision was to try and get Israel off of oil. That's where it came from. It didn't come from somebody saying, I think we ought to have electric cars, or I think the government should do incentives, or I think, that we should develop a whole new urbanistic protocol for personal mobility. It didn't come from that. It came from this idea of how do we get off of oil. And so I think these big ideas of how do we get off the carbon addiction are really an exciting place to watch. And so I think that there's the nitty-gritty of the small business and the individual action. And then there's this other thing that we need to call for, which is for the human species to get up and redesign the systems that we use.
Yeah, I would just add that, working with a wide range of suppliers from the very largest CPG firms in the United States to some very, very small companies, small companies do not lead, and large companies do not lead in the space. It's really, we see a very varied development of how far along people are kind of on this journey that we're all on. And so I think it's important to reward those that are going the right way, and certainly that's one thing that a company like Walmart can do, and we're working to do that. But it's amazing to me then, too, the companies who are doing the right things in some areas and really missing the game or missing the boat in another area. And so I think it's, as business people in the room or other functional areas, other occupations in this room, and specifically in the area of design, like Bill just mentioned, there's so much opportunity to look at how products start from the very beginning versus just the changes and things that people do in the end. And then call them green. And so we see a lot of those at Walmart. And so I guess the opportunity for building in initially in design is a tremendous opportunity and certainly something that we are now starting to ask those basic questions when we talk to our suppliers, start challenging them on what can be done versus just accepting something with a slight tweak on the end that then allows them to maybe call it green. So lots of opportunity, certainly across large and small corporations, to make changes.
As you answer this, I have a quite sort of follow-on question before you even say something. That's how I can think ahead.
we smelled something burning
what strikes me about the small and medium, I mean, supporting them is not only Walmart giving them business, but, you know, actual capital and venture capital. But right now, so much of that is on the supply side. It's going into, you know, new technologies. Are you seeing at Peregrine or at Vantage Point any interest in finding things, again, less sexy, but, you know, energy-saving technologies that are small, new ideas and getting them capital?
Yeah, so I think where some of the most interesting developments are in the clean tech space broadly is in the intersection of different disciplines. And there's at least two places where that's true. In fuels, it's the intersection between things energy and things life sciences. And then in this sector, small businesses, energy efficiency, it's the intersection between information technology, software, and energy. And here, I think on Bill's idea, to inspire people to see conservation as not the denial of a quality of life, but inspiring people to innovate, where that innovation is a massively disaggregated possibility for businesses, residences, individuals to become power centers in affirmatively generating power or recognizing that conservation is power too. And with information technology, you can bundle that and actually bid it in to the electric grid.
You don't want to say anything about, do you see any investments in energy saving versus energy supply? Demand destruction, as other people call it?
Yeah, I think there's no question that we're seeing big companies, very big companies, making very big bets on $100 to $200 million potential enterprises around building technologies, insulation especially, things like that. So, and building systems that utilize insulation as a fundamental part of the building system. So we're seeing that kind of thing coming at us relatively quickly. We're also seeing the investments in the new lighting and things like that. And then controls, I think, to get to this one thing we haven't spent much time on, it's just intelligent control systems, because from a design perspective, right now we heat, cool, and light ghosts principally. And it's basically silly when you start to look at our whole system in terms of the fact that we leave everything running when no one's around. And so the control systems that are there to remove that in significant waste, I think, are very, very, very potent.
I just wanted to underscore that back to the consumer issue and kind of getting this into the mind of the consumer. One of the biggest barriers toward people being willing to make these decisions as a consumer are that you really don't know how much energy you saved or didn't save. And answering that question is not trivial, because you have different heating days, you have different cooling days, you have a party that day, you didn't have a party that day, all these different things that make it very hard for you to say, did I really capture the savings that I was meant to capture and otherwise? And where we see a lot of excitement, if you like, in the investor space in Silicon Valley and otherwise, is precisely on these monitoring devices that sort of smartly respond to opportunities to, you know, turn down the heat while you're sleeping and turn it up right before you get up and all these sorts of things. I think there's a real opportunity in that space that will speak to the consumer hunger for a real belief in the savings that would make them more likely to make those investments.
With wireless now, it just makes it, you know, the whole wireless revolution is a revolution that hasn't hit efficiency yet. But with wireless controls, we now have the possibility of talking about retrofits at a significant level. And just even thinking in terms of wireless, you know, when somebody asked me earlier what my personal feelings were about nuclear energy, and my personal feeling is that we have this marvelous nuclear reactor 93 million miles away. It's 8 minutes and it's wireless. You know, what is our problem? You know, we can really get to work on this. So I think the wireless revolution is going to make a big difference.
Great. Thank you. I think we're going to end it there with the sun being safely 93 million miles away, just to stay very big picture. I want to thank the panelists. Thank you so much. It's been fascinating for me, and thank you all for contributing. Are you coming back up? All right, we're done. It's break time.
Ladies and gentlemen, the workshop session is now concluded. The next plenary will begin at 4 p.m. Please proceed to the Metropolitan Ballroom. Thank you.